Welcome to Dysfunctional Podcast. I am Jesus at dysfunctionaldysfunctional.com, and today we're going to be talking Lights Out. I got a chance to check out the movie and attend the press day with the cast and crew. From producer James Wan of The Conjuring comes a tale of an unknown terror that lurks in the dark. When Rebecca left home, she thought she left her childhood fears behind. Growing up, she was never really sure of what was and wasn't real when the lights went out. And her little brother Martin is experiencing the same unexplained and terrifying events that had once tested her sanity and threatened her safety. A frightening entity with a mysterious attachment to their mother Sophie has reemerged, but this time, as Rebecca gets closer to unlocking the truth, there is no denying that all their lives are in danger once the lights go out. Let's listen in on the roundtable discussion with screenplay writer Eric Hazer and producer Lawrence Gray.
So Eric, how hard was it to take a short movie? I know you totally rewrote it, but to take a short movie and elongate it into a long feature film?
Well, this is the first reason why I said no to Lawrence when I saw the short, was I was like, it's scary. It's phenomenally scary. There's absolutely no story, no characters, no ever. I have no idea what the full feet length injury is. And I confessed. If I'm looking at something that's based on a property that requires me to do all of the work, I'd rather just create an original piece because it's the same amount of work.
Right.
But he assured me, like, look, talk to David, talk to the filmmaker. He has plenty of ideas of how to make this into a full-length feature story. He has characters, he has themes, he has all kinds of stuff to work with. And I begrudgingly, I did. I was like, okay, I'll give this kid a chance, because honestly, you see this a lot in Hollywood of, like, short films get snatched up. People get excited to turn it into a film, and it collapses. And those first conversations with David were just eye-opening. He knew the characters. He had a lot of story ideas. He had a laundry list of scares. But most of all, he knew the thematic core of the film. He knew what Diana represented metaphorically, which was clinical depression. And when you have something like mental illness, when you have any theme that you can attach to your antagonist, it makes everything a lot easier, because then you know, anytime you get lost in the weeds, you're like, okay, let me just go back to my theme and find a way to make that scare anchored there, and it works. So I felt incredibly relieved and super jonesed, and I'm like, he sold me, I'm on.
And if I could add something to that, you know, the challenge of creating the whole thing from whole cloth was also turned out, I think, to be an asset, because it opened us up to being, I think, more innovative and more imaginative in the opportunities and what we could create. And at the end of the day, the movie, I think, subverts a lot of audience expectations, because we were just a few dudes sitting around a room going, what are all these amazing things we can do? And let's not do it like that, and let's be bold. So it really opened up a lot of doors.
And all of this takes place, is it in Highland Park where it was shot?
Yeah.
Was there a specific reason for that area? Because, I mean, it kind of has like an old Hollywood, you know, old L.A. type of feel to it. Was that kind of in the original, too, in terms of being set in that area?
Yeah, we wanted a place that was a little worn down, a little broken. There's sort of a subtle thing you can do in horror filmmaking where you don't have to have a monster present. You just have to show that things aren't really working as well as they should. Mm-hmm. And that will keep an audience unsettled. In fact, I think the building of dread without any scares at all is such an important element of horror, and that's something that, like, James Wan and I talked about at length, of, like, you don't have to always scare the audience, just let them know, oh, a light switch or a garbage disposal or a neon sign will not work as intended all the time. So,
it says in the press kit that house was has been used in other horror films.
Like it has a history, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I'd feel if people looked at my house and just thought there must be a demonic presence.
Well, one of the amazing things about Jen Spence, our production designer, is she made that house look like you've never seen it in a movie before. I actually had seen a bunch of those other films and didn't even recognize it after
yeah.
we got through with it.
She totally transformed
it. Does the house get on the list of possible, is there a list? These are the places
yeah,
you go.
Yeah, people who want their house to be used as a location put it on a bunch of locations list, but that actually can be a negative, because you want something, especially we did, that feels really original. And so we were skeptical about places that had been used in movies before, especially horror films. But after we saw what she was planning to do with it, we were like, oh my God, like, you've never seen it.
Mm-hmm. Also, it actually has a basement in LA.
The one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Lawrence, just real quick, did you get California tax credits to shoot this?
We did not. We did not. We were really kind of figuring out up to the wire where would be the perfect place to do the movie. And it was really funny because Eric set the movie in Los Angeles, and the studio was really thinking about going to some other locations. I was like, wow, we're going to be the first movie set in Los Angeles that shoots somewhere else. How ironic. But we thought the advantage of being in Los Angeles to be able to have the level of cast that we wanted for the movie, you know, people want to sleep in their own beds and stay with their families, and especially for the crew, this went like through and through. So it started with getting Teresa and Maria, but I remember we were sitting there and like the camera operator even was like, really amazing, and I was like, God, do you do low budget horror films? And he goes, no, I'm Steven Soderbergh's camera operator. Just happen to be free and in LA. So yeah, it was a huge advantage.
Coming from a marketing standpoint, do you guys plan on having that scare box in movie theaters?
So it's it is traveling. There's only I think two or four of them, but they're going around, and they've been such a big hit. I know there's been a talk about trying to add some more, and because it's so unique and so much fun, and so that's a good note to self.
It's probably better to go into it after.
I think coming in before was like a fun thing, and then like you know how you guys set up like the elevator scene, but coming in from the elevator was also scary, like walking into here.
Yeah.
So it's like
for me as well, by the way. It's like I was done being scared.
Can you talk about the using a real person instead of CGI? Was that ever discussed for Diana?
It's interesting, right? Because our filmmaker comes from visual effects, so sort of my expectation was that David was gonna want to lean into that in some way in the movie, and yet of all the issues, I think this one was the most unanimous. David, Eric, me, James, the studio, everyone wanted to do this practically because it felt, you know, part of what we're trying to do is create this iconic horror movie villain monster that you haven't really seen that done since movies of the sort of 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. And the kind of feeling of going more practically, of making that feel more real, more grounded, more authentic, all of that felt like the right direction to go. And we've seen films where they kind of rely heavily on CG, especially when you're doing a silhouette. Imagine the bad version of what that could look like. But it ended up being an enormous, enormous challenge for the movie in terms of how you light the film, how it's shot. Every scene has to have the exact right choreography and exposure. But the thing that really, I think, two big things really helped. One was we chose to not go with a prosthetics house that does horror movies, like, let's say, the place that does The Walking Dead. We chose to go with Matthew Mungall, who won an Academy Award for Mrs. Doubtfire, company that does really human, real characters. And then the other was finding Alicia, this woman who's just, I mean, right? Like,
contortionist,
dancer, biggest stunt woman, and the things she could do and the way she could move. That started, we started writing that into the script, and Eric can speak to that, just after knowing Alicia and seeing the kind of stuff she could do.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the casting process, like Maria and Teresa, how they're great? I think they play really great.
Yeah, well, after Eric wrote, and then I'll stop stealing this, but after Eric wrote this really moving, dramatic script, we felt like, God, we really need these amazing actors that can pull this off and live up to the standards of what he wrote. And I think we wanted somebody who was virgin to genre films before, someone who comes from really strong dramatic work. And I think it was actually James, the first time we were batting around names, just said, imagine if we could get Teresa Palmer. I was like, oh, we'll never get her. And, you know, and we were like, you know what? We've gotten everyone we've wanted so far. Let's try. And we got Teresa out of the gate, and then shooting for Maria, and then bringing all these people in. This is one of those experiences making a movie as producers where we didn't get any no's. You know, that doesn't happen very often.
We campaigned really hard, though, for Maria, because the fact that when you put those two in the same room, you're like, that's the mother and daughter. Look at them. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, I buy that.
That's funny, because I wonder why did you immediately say, what if we got Teresa Palmer, this Australian actress? Because I'm thinking, I was thinking earlier that somebody comes up with an Amish girl growing up in rural Pennsylvania. We need Teresa Palmer. She's done like 14 movies in the last year and a half.
She's a factory.
And yeah, but why do you automatically think of Teresa Palmer?
It started with James. I mean, he had either he had a personal relationship with her, or he just worked in the same circles as people who knew her.
He's Australian too, so that'd be awesome.
They all
have that strange little club. That, yeah, yeah. And said that like he's just really excited about that, and I'd seen her in More Bodies and loved her there. So we thought if she could,
that was kind of the one.
That was kind of the one.
Yeah. And she came had a baby, right? Was she?
Yeah.
She had just had a baby.
She did, and she had. So there was a couple things, but so there's the sort of like the immediate thing that kind of got her in the room. Was this idea of this amazing dramatic actress who'd done smaller parts in big, working with Terry Malick, mm-hmm. people like that, but had never fully carried one in the way that this needed. And then when I sat down with Teresa, the first thing she brought up was having a mother with mental illness, and started talking about how to make that real and how you really do, not movie react to it, but how that is in real life. And there's that scene in the movie very early on where Rebecca and Sophie have this fight about their history and about Martin coming with Rebecca, and that's the moment where you settle in the movie. The first time you watch it, you're like, whoa, this is like a real drama. This is like chilling and haunting. And
that was in my cover letter. Like when I found out my rep's going to send Teresa this script, I did a little letter at the start saying that the way I developed this script, I started by writing a drama. It was 70 pages, and it was all just the characters and the arc and how Rebecca evolves from start to finish. And then I went back in and I put in all the scares. So know that the core of that is there, Teresa, and please, dear God, join us.
You mentioned the influence of James, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit more broadly about him, because he's really become a horror master, and people look at his name and have now certain expectations. So can you tell me about what he brought to the whole big picture of this?
Well, early on, like he's it's a bit like standing in saying, I'm about to go off to war, can you tell me what the experience is? Mm-hmm. And he has so much wisdom in this field. Like, he's learned so many lessons the hard way. It was great just talking about, from his perspective, just a lot of key ingredients you need to put into this thing in order to make sure that it holds at the end of it. And whether it came down to just the nature of horror or the characters, like, he and I, the great thing about this is that we all got along and saw eye to eye on all the key things as soon as it was brought up to the table, which is so vital to know that everybody involved is making the same movie. But one of the things that James mentioned that we all nodded heads were, you can't have the horror movie now with the disposable teens, the jerks and the idiots that, like, where you make your villain the hero, so you're like, you're cheering when he kills everybody. That used to be a thing, you know? And it's just, it's not sustainable anymore. I mean, it could be done as almost like a comedy horror mix, but if you're trying to make a legitimately scary movie, if you care about the characters, you're even more afraid when they're in jeopardy.
Yeah, well, the other thing you can't do anymore, I guess, is be graphically violent. You know, like the torture porn era, maybe because people see enough of it on the news. But
well, you can. We just had no
interest. No, but I can't think of one in several years that had caught anybody's attention. I mean, it just seems to not be a thing that people do anymore. But doors opening and closing and scary things. Was that something conscious? You know, because there is a little bit of violence in the movie, people being thrown around, sure. A leg being scratched. I mean, were you conscious of the line?
There was a couple of dead bodies.
There was yeah. But they were desiccated. And
right.
There's really only blood in the opening scene of the movie.
That's true.
So, yeah, I mean, that was a very, in terms of the sort of spirit and tone of the movie from the very beginning, we wanted to do something just elevated and broadly appealing and not do a gore fest for, you know, to fetishize torture porn.
Yeah.
Plus, the less you show, the more
you're going to let your audience fill in the lines. I remember like the exit polls on like people who saw Seven for the first time. They were like, why did I have to see Gwyneth Paltrow's head in the box? And you never do. And so the more we could hold back, it wasn't because we were aiming for a rating. It was just like, how can we have let this linger in the audience's mind?
Horror icons from, you know, that we talk about 30 years after, Michael Myers, Jason, Freddy, they all have like really cool origins, and people, but they're just like touched upon, and then people want to know more. I really liked what you guys did, where you teased the origins of, was it Diana, the villain, and it just like, but it didn't give us too much, but it's like, wait, I want to know more. How did you guys come about going with their little origin?
I mean, this is Eric's Waterloo, so I won't steal his thunder in the movie, but it was a really important thing to Eric specifically from the very beginning. To not spoon feed the mythology and history of Diana to the audience, that this is something that we want intelligent people to come to and have lots of questions as they go through the movie. Some of those questions will be answered and some of those questions won't be answered. Can we dial it just enough to be satisfying, but treat the audience in a way that we've all, you know, seen so many of these films. It's in our vocabulary, and can we use audience's imagination to do something you haven't quite seen before that feels really original?
That was a very nice way of saying that. I was a real stubborn prick about it. They were kind of like, Eric, can it just be a demon? No, it's not a demon. Well, how is this a ghost? It's a ghost. She's dead. No, I don't want to do that either. I really want to, this is a Twilight Zone. This is something new. It's like, well, if it's something, oh, why do you do that? Like, because you need more mythology. You need to, like, put some more. No, I'm not putting in more exposition. I'm going to make this a little fuzzy over here and a little fuzzy. Like,
and you have to say, in the studios, to everyone's defense, when a writer goes, oh no, I'm doing something totally new, that's usually I haven't really thought this through, I'm fucking insane. But with Eric, actually, as he went and explained it out, you got to see how thoughtful this was and how clear that plan was. And honestly, we did, the brilliance of David Sandberg is, we did a couple pickups. David brought his own personal camera, shot some stuff with no sound, just to create an emotional, visceral experience to help supplement what Eric was doing that actually was really effective in the movie.
You also didn't do the obvious thing and set up a sequel.
You know, we think the audience decides that. Yeah. So
we don't do that. We don't make that choice.
And this was a very, how would you say it? It's not your typical horror film where it's like you said, like ghosts and gory things. It's realistic. So, was it a nightmare that you had, and it came to life? Like, how did
I had a lot of nightmares. So, I mean, you get to writing on stuff like this at late at night. It carries with you. It shows up in your subconscious.
Please take this as a compliment. This film is refreshingly short, and everything is said. Everything is done. It has to be done. There's no fat on it. Was that the plan from the start? Did you?
Yeah. Both David and I were no nonsense about that. We're like, you know, a lot of movies are too long these days.
Yeah.
And we really just don't want to waste audiences' time. If there's a way that we can do this elegantly and efficiently, we'll stick with that, even if the running time looks a little bare. And he delivered on that.
How many pages was the script?
Was it like 94 or something like that? Originally?
Something like that. Oh, yeah, in the 90s.
Yeah, it was in the 90s.
It is one of the few movies I've ever worked on where length was never an issue. It always just felt right from the first time we screened the film to the end. We never added scenes or felt like we had to cut things. It just felt, even though, you know, like you said, it's probably short relative to some of the other similar films, we just felt like that's the right length for this story. So
it works.
And also, I think that last 20 minutes being such a like roller coaster ride punctuates that. You don't feel like, oh, I'm wanting for anything more, right?
You produced It Follows, right?
No, I'm just working with the writer-director of that film.
Okay. Well, my best question...
I would love to have.
That was a good movie.
But, you know, when you were talking about working out the script and not making this or that be obvious, you know, I think back to what I felt in this film. Well-told story, you know, definitely has good character work. all the virtues a movie should have, and better than your average horror movie, which is just, ugh, scare, you know, and incoherent. But so many of those don't seem to do as well with, I guess, the basic horror audience as just the more, shall we say, dumbass, straight-up scare. Any concerns about that, that you've made, you know, too good of a movie in this genre?
Gotta go back and...
No, you know, the first... the studio sets up a really challenging... you know, when they make a low-budget movie, they don't know they're going to release the film. So they set up these hurdles to make sure your film is as good as you think it is. And we screened the first preview in a location where all of the movies that you just referenced get previewed out in Winnetka. We see this all the time. And that's the real test. And the audience had exactly the opposite reaction. Oh my God, a movie that people tried to do something good from the beginning. You didn't set out to make an exploitation film and then try to do some good things to please us. You guys did your own thing that you did for yourselves. This movie's just great. And it does. It subverts so many of the expectations and so many of the tropes and cliches that you have seeing those movies. I think it's the opposite. I think it's really clearly, as we're seeing from our audience reaction, that, that people were starving for something like that.
Eric, I was going to ask you about the schizophrenia. Did you do a lot of research on that? Did you already know something about it? Was it something familiar to you?
I had an extended family member who dealt with paranoid schizophrenia. And that was a real load on my family and my relatives. And it was interesting to see, either through social media or through personal encounters, how many members of my family just walled that up and tried to ignore it and say that it really wasn't there, versus how many would engage with my, you know, with my aunt, my cousin, and that was more difficult for me to deal with than, you know, a lot of like the actual career writing projects. When I just wanted to shake some of those people and say, like, he's flesh and blood. Like, you don't try to ignore this problem. And so, coming at something where the villain is literally kept in the dark, like, I knew what to play with there. And the lines, the dialogue were like, I if some of my relatives end up seeing this movie, they're gonna be like, I said that. How dare you? There's one about where Maria Bello's character says, I'm not gonna go talk to some stranger about my problems. That's exactly what we heard from.
Is it a hot button issue in a way? Because, you know, a lot of activists for mental illness say there's too much connection of mental illness and violence. I mean, she is not herself violent, but
no. It might, you know, like the whole reason here is that the less that you communicate, or, you know, if you try too late to try and solve a problem, the most you can get out of that is a Pyrrhic victory, you know. And it's better to, like, be open and forthcoming about it as soon as possible and keep talking about it.
And I'll say that the first time Eric said that about the family member was the first time I think it really connected. It was very early on where it connected with me how universal the story is that we're telling. Eric said, yeah, you know, I'm really doing this thing about this family member. I start talking about it. And I go, no, actually, I've been putting in a bunch of stuff about this really close friend of mine going through this. And David said, no, I did this documentary on this woman.
Yeah.
I've been putting in. And we realized, wow, every person close to the project has someone, they've been touched by this. And obviously it's a universal experience. So many of us have that. And then meeting Teresa and her mother, and Maria had a similar experience. So I think it's something that touches so many people, not something to shy away from, something to really illuminate.
Yeah, I mean, I've been dealing with someone with schizophrenia, so I feel like, and mental illness is now something very big in the news, so I think the movie is very relatable to a lot of people, even though it's scary, but, you know, I think you guys did a great job.
That's great, thank you.
Now that we got a little insight on how a short film became a feature film, let's check out the discussion with the creator of Lights Out, director David Sandberg, and his wife, actress Lotta Lisson.
So the film's being screened a lot. That shows a lot of confidence, right?
Yeah.
So how do you guys feel about it? I loved it, by the way. And I think it's something that I'm so glad that horror movies are being taken serious again.
Yeah.
Conjuring this year, Lights Out now.
Yeah, I was very pleasantly surprised, because when we were finished with it, I think that, yeah, I think this, people can like this, but critics probably won't. But so far, so good.
Well, it's 100%, it's 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. And just so you know, one of the sites I run, Nerd Report, Rotten Tomatoes, 100%, we got quoted on the commercial. Thank you very much.
I was in charge of that. Yeah. Thank
you for
the great.
I'm a really big fan of the original short film. And this is when I found out that it was announced to be in film production. I was like, they better not mess this up. Like, it's just so effective.
That was beef. We felt that too.
Yeah.
We better not mess it up now.
I had a friend who sent it to me in the middle of the night. And it just, like, my life has not been the same since. I'm actually afraid of the dark, so I was like, no. But I was so excited to see the movie. Can you tell us a bit about sort of going from the production of the short and then even coming back to it now as a feature? And your cameo is great.
Thank you. It's been a year and a half.
Since we came here.
It started, we made the short film in our apartment just for a film horror competition. So we thought that was what that life would be for that short. And we wanted to get money from the Swedish Film Institute to make bigger movies, because that's how you get money in Sweden, you get government grants. But they felt that we were too unexperienced. So we thought, okay, if we do these shorts, we might have something to show them that we can do these things with no money at all. Give us money, we can do better. But then all of a sudden in March 2014, it just started to get all these views within an hour or within a night.
Yeah, it just blew up. Like, I saw that someone had linked to it on Reddit. It's like, oh, hey, that's our short. And I went in and I saw, oh, 8,000 views. That's amazing. Then all of a sudden it was like 70,000 views. And it just kept going. And then we were sitting there watching it go over a million, like refreshing the page.
We had friends sitting in their homes at the same time, but this is better than an election because you know the good thing will win. It's just such a great film, but we didn't know all these views, will they ever mean anything, or is it just views? Is it just number underneath the video? Will it actually translate to something real?
Then we started getting lots of emails from Hollywood. From, like, managers, agents, and producers, and studios, and it was just insane how, like, a 2.5-minute short can get all that attention. Like, I had to make, like, a spreadsheet of everyone I talked to and what was said last, just to keep track of it all, because I was on the phone, like, all evenings, just because of the time difference. So, you know, the days were sort of normal, and then the evenings was like, okay, gotta talk to Hollywood. And I had to get, like, an IMDb Pro account just to, to look up who these people were. It was just amazing.
The Swedish, when the Swedish news found out about it, they found out about it through international sites, so they didn't even know we were Swedish. So David got an email in English talking about, is it possible to get an interview? And he wrote back, is it okay if I answer
Swedish?
In Swedish? Because they had no idea. This has just turned into something so big that Sweden didn't even
Did the idea to turn the short into a feature come from Hollywood suggesting it to you? Okay. So did you already have ideas kind of percolating? Okay. So give me a sense of once that became the direction, how did you get to where you got?
I mean, we only ever intended for it to be this little fun contest submission. So it's like, okay. So what will a feature version be? Because it can't just be someone in an apartment for the whole film.
Turning the lights off and on.
Yeah.
I don't know. You did a pretty good job with what you did here.
It felt like we didn't really have a story in the short. It was more just a concept and two scenes. So it felt like as long as we stayed true to the concept, the feature could be anything, really. So, yeah, it started with this sort of mental illness idea that felt like that sort of a darkness in some way. And I had this idea of, you know, in a lot of horror movies you have a little kid who has an invisible friend. Like, the parents are like, oh, that's creepy, and it turns out to be a ghost. But I always figured that it would be scarier if it was the parent who had the invisible friend, because then as a child you're dependent on your parent.
Right.
What are you going to do then? So it started with that and turned into this sort of family drama, because I wanted to keep it contained, just because, partly because if I was going to do a movie, I wanted to have a handle on it. Like, I've never done a movie before. I don't want to do, you know, Independence Day or something like that.
But also because it kind of fit the short film. It's just me in our apartment. It would be strange if the movie version of it was with a whole lot of people in a big city or something. It needed to be that intimate, contained feeling with people that you care about.
And so what happened was the one of the first producers I talked to was Lawrence Gray, who was really into it, and he really seemed to know what he was talking about. And he said, you know, I know James Wan. We've been talking about maybe doing something together, and maybe this could be it. So he talked to James, and James had seen the short online and thought it was really cool, but he didn't really know if there was enough there for a movie. So I wrote down a treatment for what I wanted the movie to be and all the characters, and Lawrence showed that to James, which made him come on board and see that, okay, there's actually something here. So Lawrence flew us out here and to meet with
November, just to see everybody.
Yeah, to meet with James, and James brought New Line there because he has his relationship with them, and then it just sort of everything just came together really quickly and smoothly, which I hear it's not usually how things work.
For us, it felt like after that trip in November, it felt like it was forever and nothing really happened until March when we got here a year and a half ago. And it felt like the longest time because it was all, oh, we think we have news next week. Next week we have news next week. Yeah. And then nothing happened. And then all of a sudden, I had a job to go to every day. So I told them, I might be going to Hollywood and I might need some time off, but I don't know when. Is that okay? And they had followed this entire story, so they wanted to help as best as they could. So, but when it happened, it was like they called and said, "Can you come on Friday? It's happening." Yeah. So I had to call my job, and they said, "Okay, we can't give you off time, but so you have to quit. But if you come back, you have a job here." I thought, okay, we will be back in 4 months' time, and then maybe we will fly back and forth for a while. But we kind of quickly noticed we will be staying here now. So.
It's just it's so insane that we got that call. It's like, movie's happening, get on a plane. It's like, okay, lock the door and go to the airport. And when we landed here for the first week, I think the studio paid for a hotel, but then we had to find some place to stay, so we just stayed in different Airbnbs around town. Like, first was at like a garage in Burbank.
No one knows.
It's just now that we have an apartment here.
Yeah, because you need credit score, and we don't have credit score, so it was impossible for us to kind of get a good lease anywhere else. So
can
it was
you
just
say
monthly
I'm
renting
a Hollywood movie?
Everyone's doing that here. Yeah.
the next horror story is set in Airbnb, right? Your next horror film is going to be set in an Airbnb.
Oh yeah.
Lotta, what was your job?
How did you come up?
Sorry.
With
what was your job?
I was working at a group home for people with Asperger and Down syndrome.
So how did you guys come up with the short? And this horror film is really different from other horror films because it's more of a drama. So can you explain that, both of those?
The short film was just that feeling when you're home and you go into the bathroom in the middle of the night and you see something. We had a new coat rack that we had just put up at the end of the hallway. And it's like, it's big, like a human being. Mm-hmm. So the first few days, every time I went to the bathroom, that feeling of, oh, somebody's there, standing there. So we just kind of...
Yeah, it turned into like, what if there actually was something there every time you turned off the lights?
It wasn't IKEA, was it?
No.
It's just IKEA for it to light the film, build lights and build a dolly.
Well, speaking of lighting, you know, not only are you making your first feature film here, but one that is so dependent, you know, every film is about light and darkness, right?
Yeah.
Fundamentally. But so much about it here. Can you talk about directing those sequences where light and dark are just so
important? It was really hard just because we have this antagonist who can't be in light.
Right.
So you can't light her. We had to figure out all these ways of just lighting the background, because I didn't want to cheat and have like a rim light or something like that. I wanted to stay true to, you know, she cannot be in light. So it took a lot of sort of storyboarding to figure out how we actually shoot that. Like when she grabs Brett and throws him out into the hallway, it was like, okay, so if he's using his flashlight on the thing, if he holds it like this, when she grabs him, then it's pointed backwards and it's sort of lighting the wall behind him, which makes her so. So it took a lot of that, and it also took a lot of sort of arguing with the camera team, because I didn't want to do Hollywood darkness where you have just blue light everywhere, where you still see everything. I want to have actual darkness where like evil could be hiding, and that was very new to the crew. Like it took a lot of sort of convincing. And one thing that happened was when Gabriel was walking around with the candlelight, I only wanted him to be lit by the candlelight, and they were like, "Oh, you can't do that. You have to actually light the scene." But then when we actually shot the scene, James Wan visited the set, and he was like, "You know, you should shoot that scene with just candlelight." and people were like, "Yeah, that's a great idea." So I was like, "What the hell?" Yeah.
No, so the short, it was all those things that turned out good in the short is so much because of budget reasons. Like the hallway, we took what we had and we made a kind of a concept because of it. So like the sound design is a very big part of it because I'm the only person in it, so we needed like the sound steps of somebody else coming towards me, and the darkness sort of become this extra person, the frightening thing. So in the feature they had to kind of stick to the rules and make them even bigger and make them even more professional.
I was surprised that the look changed, because I'm just seared into my memory is the makeup that you had for the original.
Well,
there's no makeup there.
Though. That's actually photoshopping. Yeah. So I photoshopped her face.
Yes.
So well, that was kind of fun because we had a test screening, and you know, we for this movie we had this sort of Oscar-winning makeup team make this super expensive makeup. And one of the audiences and test members were like, "I actually like the face better in the short." I was like, "No, damn, it spent all these money," and they liked my silly Photoshop.
It was important to keep like the silhouette. So the silhouette is kind of similar, but even more crazy and strange and crooked. So that was kind of, that is how the ghost is looking and lights out. So the face was just something that needed to be very scary and kind of connected to the story. In the short, there's no story, so it's just a creepy face.
What was your reaction to shooting your scene? And was that the first time you saw their version of Diana in person?
I actually saw her on set. I was there because this is our baby, so I was there at set every other day. And my scene was shot the last day on set. So I kind of knew the whole team then, so that was good for me. But I tried to kind of get in that feeling that we were back in our apartment in Gothenburg, because it was just so much people. And when we shoot our shorts, we do them so much together as a teamwork. So I can look at the screen afterwards and see if it's okay to move on. Am I satisfied with this? But on this big set, it's so much people and you don't really... It's more intimidating, I guess. So it was more hard to get in the character, obviously, but I tried to kind of focus on, I am the only one here that has ever been directed by David before. I know this guy. We can talk Swedish and no one will understand. So it was really fun. It was great work to work with a real like Hollywood actor, with Bill Burke.
Can you talk about the realistic horror? You know, my second question earlier about how, like, you were able to make this horror film that's usually classified as, like, gory and all that things, but this is pretty realistic.
Yeah, I mean, my sort of tastes have changed. When I was younger, I used to love gory horror movies, and now I'm more about sort of suspense and sort of terror. And that was actually... So that's the film I wanted to make. And then when we got the PG-13 rating, I was actually kind of worried, just because I know a lot of horror fans will see that and go like, "Oh, that's some watered down studio film that's not going to be scary." But I mean, the fact is, if you don't have a lot of blood or gore in it, then you won't get an R rating. Because I mean, I think The Ring was PG-13, and a lot of scary movies have been PG-13.
But it's also like you really care for the actors or the characters in the movie. In the short, there isn't really a character, but people recognize themselves in me, and they say that that's what makes it powerful to them, because they can, they don't want me to die, because they kind of recognize themselves in that moment. So it was important to keep that part, and so that's partly why I think the drama is there, because it needs to be that you care about them, and for to be able to care about people, you need to know about them. So you need to kind of get that feeling of it.
And that was a fun thing, just coming up with these, because when you make a 3-minute short, you don't have time for character stuff, or like it's just concept. So, but now we could come up with all these character backstories and stuff, and all these little details. Like, you know, I had this idea that Rebecca would have been so traumatized that she became like a cutter. So we have these, she has these scars on her arms, and like, look, we don't really focus on it, or any, no one really mentions it, but I think it sort of adds to her character that she's been so messed up by all this that's happened.
Along with like the practical lighting, you did a lot of practical effects work through this, which has been a nice little movement that's gotten started lately and very effective. Why did you want to make sure you did things in that way rather than rely on a lot of digital trickery?
Well, I think when you have CGI characters, even though they can look really good these days, there's still a part of your brain that goes like, oh, that thing wasn't really there when they shot it. So I wanted to have that physical presence of someone there. And that, of course, helps the actors as well, because they see the exact same thing that the audience will see. And
I never saw Alicia's face until a few weeks ago. I just saw her in that creepy costume. And when she was sitting at lunchtime eating with these nails and trying to not the makeup, it's just, yeah, she looked super creepy, so that really helped.
In a movie where light is at a premium, is the sound more important? I mean, do you find...
I mean, horror movies in general, you can have... I think sound just adds to your imagination. You can have like a pitch black room and you just hear these creepy noises, and that will many times be scarier in your mind than whatever rubber suit you have, you know?
Did the original film win the competition?
No.
I did win Best Director, but it didn't make the
we
top six finalists.
What happened? What won?
It was a short called Playtime.
Do you have a certain fondness for the short film medium, because it is kind of, I guess, where you started? Do you think you'll continue doing some shorts in addition to feature films?
Yes.
We did a short After Lights Out that we put up online. And I mean, to us, it's such a different thing, because that's something we can make by ourselves with our own sort of rules. And
we can change things on the spot. If something doesn't feel right, we can change it. We don't need to go through all these mediums and all these people. So it feels like it's a freedom and sort to be able to.
That's the great thing about being a filmmaker now, that all these tools are available and cheap or even free, that you can create whatever you want. And it feels like, you know, for us, it's that's sort of a, like a safety net, because if this Hollywood thing doesn't work out, then we can still make our shorts, because no one can stop us, you know, as long as we have a camera and, you know.
How does your collaboration sort of work? How do you come up with stories together and get, you know, it made?
It's usually the ideas come from David's twisted brain sometimes, and then he kind of, it's usually like, I say, we need to do something. I have all these ideas. And then David goes and thinks for a while, and then he comes back, but I have this idea. Okay. And then we kind of talk through it, and I have ideas by myself, and we kind of just decide on what to do. And then when it's time to shoot, it's like David is super wise advisor, and I'm the...
When it's just the two of us, we have sort of all the time in the world, and we can sort of figure things out. So on Lights Out, for example, I wanted her to, okay, at this point, I want you to hide underneath the covers. And she was like, but why would I do that? So it's like...
weird. I'm a grown woman. I wouldn't hide if I don't have anything kind of running towards me.
Yeah, so that's what's like...
attacking me.
Okay, let's add footsteps coming towards you. And she was like, okay, that works. That would make me hide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then it's like we don't have producers, we don't have like all these things, marketing. We have ourselves. We put it online. We do everything together. So it feels very much like a joint work.
Now let's hear from the cast about how they felt being part of such a unique project. Up first, Teresa Palmer and Alexander DiPersia. Palmer plays Rebecca, and DiPersia plays her boyfriend Brett.
Okay, so before taking on the project, or while you're reading the script, did you get a chance to see the short film, and what were your initial thoughts on that?
Yeah, I did. You watched it too, right? Yeah, I started watching it. It was quite funny. That the same night I met with Lawrence and the director, David, I was like, oh, okay. Sat in bed. My husband was out. my baby son was asleep next to me. I start watching it. I get a minute in, and I'm like, nope, I will not be watching this tonight. So the next morning, like, it was like so bright out. My husband was right next to me. I was like, you're watching this with me. And then we finished it, and he turned to me and he said, you have got to do this movie. So yeah, it was really
funny. I had this a similar experience. You get that first light scare, and I was like, not gonna watch it right now. Yeah. And then I watched it, and I kind of made my way through it, and I was staying with a friend, and they watched it and took the laptop and literally threw it across the room. And they're like, nope, love you, not going to see it, we're good, we're going to stay where we are.
Your character is so understanding as a boyfriend that, I mean, you're like super guy, and he's like,
I've lived in Hollywood a long time. It's been a while to be understanding of the baggage that comes, you know. This is a little more, I guess, than usual.
Would you be willing to like go into and dealing with a situation like this in real life where, you know, you're
he's like, oh, I just want to stay, and then she's like, well, we've got this kid too. I'm like, kids I'm fine with. She's like, well, there's just one other thing for the crazy mom. And he's like, and beyond the crazy mom, we've got this one other thing that kind of carries us around.
Good.
And he's like, well, I'm in already. I got here. I might as well stay.
Did you guys find that, because was her name Alicia who played?
Alicia.
Yeah. Was it more helpful to you to have that person there? And did they hide her from you when you weren't doing the scenes so you wouldn't see her behind the scenes?
They
so that it'd be more of a scare when you see her when you're shooting?
Well, my first scene, I hadn't really seen her. But the thing is, I know Alicia.
Oh.
She was my stunt double on I, number 4. We became really good friends. We went to the gym together. And then she texted me. She's like, I'm in your movie. I'm playing this entity. And so I knew that she was in the suit. But they didn't, I think for that reason, they didn't tell me when she was on set for the first time and I was shooting. And I didn't realize she was down there, like, scratching on the floor.
I remember that scene. Yeah,
she's like, scratching. And then I'm, like, doing it. And then I see her, and I actually screamed out loud. And everyone started laughing. I was like, I'm so sorry. We have to start again. Like, ah! But, yeah, so, I mean, initially it was very shocking to see her in real life. I had no idea what she was going to look like. And just the way she was able to contort her body is terrible.
I never saw her once, I don't think, until like the last week of shooting. And she has such a soft voice, and she's so sweet that in between she was like, that was fun, right? And I was like, stop talking to me. It's so crazy the way she physically embodied the character, that at all times she kind of had this walk with
on her tiptoes.
Yeah.
And then seeing her in the chair, like reading a book.
Texting.
So weird.
Texting somebody.
Doing selfies as Diana. I was like, this is bizarre.
Well, I was going to say, when we were in the screening that I watched with you, we were cheering you on big time. Inventive ways to get light on yourself. And light.
Yeah, we found more ways to find light in that movie than I think anybody ever
has.
There were so many points in the theater last night where people were like, he's dead. When you were reading the script, you're like, this is where I buy it. This is where it goes.
I'll be honest, I cheated. I skipped directly to the end of that.
But do I die?
Where are we?
In the pound of emotions that an actor has to draw on, how easy is it to go back to scared shitless over and over and over again?
with that creature in front of us, it made it a lot easier.
Definitely.
A lot easier. We constantly kept the house we shot in very, very dark, so your only break was to step outside and to breathe in the fresh air. And as we talked about earlier, sometimes there were just mannequins hanging out outside, which didn't make
scratch
it
our face like,
that much easier. But the whole time we shot, it was dark.
Yeah, the energy kind of followed you around, too. It was I think everyone felt a little uneasy in that house.
Oh, you're a little on edge the whole time. That house yeah. itself, without props, would scare anyone.
Very scary. No offense to the owner. But yes, exactly. it is really creepy. We were all very afraid in your house. But yeah.
Thank you.
But thanks so much for letting us film there.
What was your reaction when you actually saw the film the first time? Was it a whole different thing?
It was a whole different thing. I didn't know what to expect. Teresa saw it before I did, and she called me. She's like, "It's so good," and I was like, "I can't wait to see where it comes." You know, there were times throughout the shooting where we were like, "This moment's like a little bit comic. Does it work? Are we sure this is going to work out?" And then when I saw the finished product, I was like, "Wow, it works!" Because you get these comic moments that soften you up, that make you feel okay, and then a second later, it's just like. Boom! And you're jumping out of your seat. You're spilling your popcorn again, and it was amazing seeing the finished product.
How I think for me, I was really shocked because I was in the room. And I was like, "Oh, this will be fine." I've read the script. I was there. I'm staring at my big head on the screen, yet I'm still so invested in the story. My feet are up on the chair. I'm literally like this. I was wearing a scarf that day. And I had it around my face. And I was getting laughed at by my friends because they're like, "Why are you scared? Like, this is crazy." But truly, it affected me in a way I was not expecting. And I ended up being just transported to this world. And it was terrifying. I mean, it was truly, I found it absolutely terrifying.
Well, neither of us were there for the filming of the opening sequence, which I think
sets the tone.
Just crushed us when we saw it. And I wasn't there for the filming of the basement scenes, which were, for me, absolutely terrifying seeing those mannequins for the first time on screen.
Did becoming a mom before you did this movie, did that affect how you kind of came into it and looked at this character? Did you have a different sense of what family meant coming in?
Yes, certainly. I think being a mom opens you up emotionally in every aspect, but certainly the dynamic with my little brother was... I felt feelings for him that I haven't felt on movies before. I was such a mama bear to not only the character but also the actor. I wanted to make sure that he was okay, and I could see that he really had to go to some very vulnerable places to portray this so realistically, and I was always checking in with him and making sure he was okay and talking him through scenes, and I've never been really like that before. I just kind of goof around with my co-stars, but I was like very much emotionally invested in his well-being, and it helped our dynamic on screen too. Like, I really loved him and cared about him. And actually, my older son, I'm pregnant with my third son, so my oldest son, my stepson's his age, so my stepson would come to set all the time, and they'd be interacting and kicking the soccer ball out the front of the house, and it was just really lovely to have that environment.
We might have kicked the soccer ball.
You guys kicked the soccer ball a few times too. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and remember they had the, like, baseball gloves and the, like,
we were pitching
there,
like, "You guys have to stop. Go inside."
I know!
Like, Bobby, kids running around, we had a blast.
Yeah, it was really fun.
How did you both get these parts? Did they come to you?
He was amazing, and I read with him in the room, and we knew straight away. I had met with them, and I had agreed to do the movie, and... we all decided to work together on this film, and then they were like, "Oh, we got to find this great guy." So I went and read with a bunch of different guys, and he came in all like straggly hair, and I was like,
"Not too similar to what's going on."
And I was like, "All right, cool." And then we started reading, and he just played it in a different way from anyone else that we had seen that day. Like, I really like this because his take was a little left of center, and I was like, "This is interesting. Like, this is what people want to see on screen: is vibrant and new and refreshing." And then I think you probably found out pretty quickly.
No, that story was amazing. I had come into read with Teresa, and I had a wedding I had to go to, and I kept canceling my flights to the wedding, so I had to borrow a friend's car to drive to Napa, and I drove 8 hours to Napa, and I got to Napa, and they were like, "You got the part." I'm like, "Amazing." They're like, "How soon can you be here?" I was like, "What do you mean?" They're like, "Can you come in like in a few hours?" I'm like, "No, I just drove to Napa." They're like, "And?" And I was like, "And I'm here for a wedding. I can't, can I have a few hours?" They're like, "Just be back tomorrow morning at like 9 a.m. And I think we were on set the like next. 5 a.m. Monday, no clothes on.
Yeah, we passed.
You know, time to do sit-ups and eat protein or whatever.
It was like 3 to 4 days before we started shooting was our...
Really?
Read together.
we read together Friday morning and started shooting Monday morning.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly it.
Yeah. I was like, what was going to happen if we didn't write it
by now? I know. If we're like, they all suck. No.
How many days did it take to shoot the whole movie?
I think it was a 5-week shoot, was it?
Yeah, 5 weeks. Five or six?
Five weeks.
I like that when it's that concentrated and...
It's quite... condensed. It was long days, but we shot in LA. It was quite
fun. But it was long days. It was a lot of emotion, a lot of stuff going on throughout those days. It was a lot of going home and just passing out.
Yeah, well, not for me.
Yes, that,
not for
mine
me.
Was a little bit easier.
He gets to go home sleeping if he isn't working the next day. I'm like up no matter what.
Can you talk about working a little with Maria?
Oh my gosh, she's so phenomenal. We all loved her. She's such an amazing character, and I was really conscious about this woman, my mother in the film, because this is a horror film, and I read the script and I was like, but this character is so important to the story, and we need to have someone who comes in and portrays mental illness in the most realistic, authentic way, someone who really gets it and understands it. And I know so much about mental illness. It's all through my family, I've experienced it, I know it so well, that I'm very sensitive to when it's portrayed on screen. I can call it if it doesn't feel realistic. So I was like, who are they going to get for this? Then when I heard it was Maria Bello, I was like, this is the best thing that's ever happened to this movie. This is incredible. And then I saw her on day one and what she did with it. And I was so moved by it because I was instantly thrown into the scene and I was present with her and just watching, even the way she moved her fingers and the little like nuanced behavior she injected into the movie. It was like she was doing a performance that you would see someone be nominated for at the Academy Awards. I mean, it was just so real. And that's what
I did. Yeah, I agree. I have friends and family with mental illness as well, so you don't know what to expect. There's a lot of over the top. There's a lot of not getting it right. But she brought, like Teresa said, with the movement of the fingers and the unsteadiness and the wanting to go one direction and then going another. It was just on point. It was accurate. It wasn't overdone.
And it made you care about her and
care
about this dynamic and believe these people.
How do you believe it? You felt bad for what she was going through.
Yeah.
Well, on the topic of mental illness, you guys all learned working on the movie that everybody's just a few degrees away from it in their personal lives.
Right.
I bet if we went around this table, you'd find the same thing. So
absolutely.
Tell me what it meant to you to kind of use that as a horror allegory, in a sense, in this movie, and to kind of make it real while you're kind of doing a, you know, scary horror interpretation of it.
I think allegorically you could say that Diana could be an expression of depression in some people. There's a way to look at it in that
metaphor.
Sense. Yeah. It made it more real. It made it more realistic. It wasn't just this ghost that came and haunted this family. It went much deeper than that. And having Maria portray that and then having it trickle down to Teresa's character, who obviously brought some of that from her family life when she was young, and then trickle down to Gabriel's character as well, it made the story more cohesive. And I think easy might not be the right term, but it did make it easier for us as actors to get into the story and to relate to it.
Yeah, because it felt like, I mean, for me, the way I was so committed to this character, I felt like I was in a drama, like I was in a dramatic movie, and I didn't play it any differently to some of the films that, like Mel Gibson's Hacksaw Ridge. Like, I approached it the same way, and there just so happened to be a supernatural element to the story, and I think we all just wanted to breathe this real energy into these characters. And to me, I think it's one of the things that makes the film really work, because I know these people in real life. I know all of these characters. I've met them before. I've interacted with them, and so it makes it work.
Yeah, the scares are there, but we had this story at the root of everything, the story of family and struggle and trying to work things out. The scares came. The scares were obviously a big part of the movie. It's a quote-unquote horror movie. I'm sure you guys saw the scares. But at the root of it was a family dealing with real family issues. And for me, a guy trying to figure out how to get his way into it. How can he navigate it and how can he handle it? So it made it better for us as actors to be able to just face it, like Teresa said, like shooting a dramatic film.
Is this a new trend? Back in the day, like, you had The Omen, you had The Exorcist. It seems like horror films were taken more serious, like you said, more drama and stuff, great acting. Is this a trend, you think, that's coming with, you know, we have The Conjuring and Lights Out? Are we going to see more, is horror taken more serious?
Yeah, I think so. I hope so, certainly. You've got this campy idea of horror films for a very long time. You know, there's some good-looking people, they're going to end up dead, they're going to make the wrong decisions, and that's what's going to happen. And I think people have realized that that's fun, that's all good, but there's a way to inject a bit more heart into it and a bit more substance into it. And we've seen it with James's films for the last few years, and I think we're starting to see it now with other films as well, and we certainly see it in this film. You care about these people. You don't want them to suffer. You don't want them to die at the end. And I hope that we move in that direction with these films.
Is James hands-on with the film? Like, does he come out and see you guys on set and talk to you about it?
Yeah, he came to visit a bunch of times. But what I loved about him is he's obviously the king of this genre. But he so fiercely put his trust in David Sandberg that he definitely just handed him the reins. And he would oversee the process. And every now and then he'd come in with this really brilliant note. Even if it's just to move something from one spot to another, it would make such a tremendous difference.
With the biggest smile on his face.
Yeah, like so sweet. I know, it's like for a guy who makes such dark films, it's completely
polar. No, bring him up 15 feet in the air. 10 feet's not enough.
Yeah, so he would come in with his notes, but really at the end of the day, I loved that he just gave over the control to David, and you could tell he just really believed in him. And so that, I thought, was really special.
I'm sure you had stunt doubles, but did you guys get hurt? Because that you really get thrown around a lot.
I had a stunt double. You know, years ago, like when I was doing Iron Number 4 and Warm Bodies, I was like, I'm doing all my stunts. I learned how to shoot the guns.
I made that mistake on this.
I was so confident about doing everything myself. And I loved it, and I really trained on those movies, and I became just like a stunt woman. And then, so I knew that I could do it if I wanted to, but I think now being a mom, I'm like, well, I'm not so invincible. I still want to have more babies. I really want to get injured. But then this time, I'm doing
this stunt guy, Norby's like, you want to do this one? I'm like, yeah, I want to do this one. He's like, are you sure? I'm like, yeah, just whip my head really hard in that direction and fall down. He's like, yeah, but like people train for this. I'm like, let's just go to the front yard and set up the pads and we do it. And I'll never do it again. I'll never do it again. They're like, you want to get rigged up? I'm like, yeah, I want to get rigged up. And I'm like, this is terrifying.
Oh, no.
Everybody's worked with first-time directors, but this is a first-time director whose previous work was a YouTube video.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, I mean, talk about fresh eyes. I wonder what that was like. Like, I mean, everything was totally new to him.
Yeah, it was really sweet. One day, he said to me, he was like, he's very quiet. You've met him. He's like
he's very quiet,
spoken, and really sweet. And he said to me one day, so quietly, "Oh, this can be stressful sometimes." I was like, "Wait, you're stressed out? That is your stressed out? Like, what we're seeing is your stressed out? Like, you're unbelievable. Like, you can
like,
never
take?
Tell."
Yeah,
like, how are you so calm? I don't understand. And even if he was stressed or he was nervous, you could never, ever, ever feel it from him. And I loved that about him. But truly, he made this short film that was so successful. That came out of his own brain. And he just picked a simple premise that's primal and instinctual, and it's the fear of the dark, and he made this story about it. So I think everyone really believed in him, and I could tell on set, just energetically, I was like, oh, he knows exactly what he's doing. We're fine. We're making a great movie.
And he put his trust in us, too, which was amazing.
He did, yeah.
It was like James put his trust in David, David put his trust in us, and we were like, uh-oh, I hope we get this right. let's not muck this one up. But it was amazing to see somebody transition from... It shows how small the world is from a YouTube video to doing a studio film. It's wild, I think, within a year.
To see that. On the private plane going to WonderCon with all the Suicide Squad cast and all these amazing actors, they were sitting, like, him and his wife were sitting on the plane, and they were sitting opposite my husband and I, and they were just, like, staring ahead quietly. And I, like, looked at them, and I was like, guys, is this blowing your mind? And then they both, like, were like, oh my gosh, this is the craziest thing that's ever happened. We can't believe this. And it was the sweetest, most endearing reaction, because they were like, how did we get here? This is so special. And it was just the most refreshing thing to see. I really, really loved it.
You mentioned you WonderCon. Are you guys going to be at Comic-Con? And if yes,
have you guys
experienced Comic-Con? Are you ready?
I'm a first-timer. Oh. Very
excited.
Okay, well, we'll see you at Comic-Con.
Thank you.
Next up, check out the discussion with Maria Bello. She plays Sophie, who Diana is attached to.
But Maria, what did you respond to with this, really at the core, dramatic movie with a horror layer on top and the allegory with mental illness? What got to you about that premise when it was brought to you?
I like that you said that. That's exactly how I felt when I read the script, which is, if you took the horror out of it, it's a standalone movie as a drama
yeah.
of this family and these complicated relationships in this family due to mental illness. So I was certainly drawn to that, and she's a wonderful character to play. A mother who's suffering from depression, off of her medication, on the verge of a psychotic breakdown, who also has this shadow self that you don't know is real. She doesn't even know if it's real at some point. And I thought that would be a really complicated, great thing to play.
How did you prepare for your film? I mean, for your role, I'm sorry.
I prepared through a lifelong of living with, I know you did, but some of you might have read my book last year where I talk about having the gift of bipolar disorder. And I was able to use my experience from that and put it on the screen for the first time, remembering what it was to be that person who couldn't get out of bed for 3 months, to, you know, really try to understand what it would be like to have my child at a time when I was in that space of not understanding what reality was. Mm-hmm. So that was a real gift.
Teresa was saying how much she was so relieved when she heard that you were cast as the mother in this, because she knew this role was going to be in good hands. And she also had some personal experience with her mom.
That's right.
So can you talk a little bit about working with her? And, you know, there is certain physical resemblance aside from just being blonde, but both of you are, you know, very dynamic actresses and people. And so how was it working with her on set?
I really dig her. She's just a cool woman. You know, as soon as we met in the trailer, it was like 5 minutes before our scene. We're like, hi, mom. Hi, daughter. She's a little kid. I'm like getting my son all organized for soccer. And we just went in and did our scene. But she's so like Aussie earth mother, really genuinely in herself. And in a second, she turns on this American accent, puts on this tough girl thing, and just does the work. She's really, really good. And I look forward to working with her more. So in a different capacity.
What I think I like the most is that we're all talking about how this is kind of a different type of a horror film, because it's, you know, it's based in, you know, reality and, like you said, in drama. But the fact that Diana is pretty much the only person who understands you. I mean, I kind of, and you don't ever get that with a horror person, you know, like a demon or whatever. You don't have that kind of connection with the human characters. So, I mean, can you kind of talk about working maybe with Alicia and sort of finding that kind of connection?
Well, first of all, have you seen Alicia? She's a supermodel. She's a gymnast, stubborn, who looks like a supermodel. So it's really funny. She's very soft-spoken, but I do believe at Comic-Con next year there will be people dressed like Diana. Because she's so creepy. The way that she moves her fingers and squats and does her... Yeah, that thing. But that's all her imagined. So she created this entire character without speaking, without ever being seen, really. Only in the shadows. So I think she did a terrific job.
Was there any trick to acting in a movie that's just so severely dark and light, you know, but physically? Was there a trick to it, or anything weird or new about it?
You know, there was that one scene where I'm talking into a closet,
mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm.
And you don't know who I'm talking to, and the truth is, there was nobody there. And so I'm kind of in the dark, talking to myself in the dark. So that was kind of interesting. It was interesting to shoot a scene or two with just with a candle.
Yeah.
I loved the lighting in this film and the not lighting in this film. Mm-hmm. And David, you captured that on his 3-minute video. You know, the reason why they found this film and did it. It has more than 100 million hits now. Mm-hmm. But he was able to do it on such a low budget and in such a practical way. No one ever guesses that Diana isn't CGI. You know?
Yeah, I
know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You don't know that she's practical and that all that lighting is practical from the phone, from the candle. Not that there's not other lights, but a lot of it was practical lighting.
Mm-hmm. And Helen C. is a first-time director.
David was wonderful. He really had no ego about him. He's like a little kid coming to Hollywood going like, what the heck am I doing here? What am I doing here? But he had a very strong vision of what he wanted. You could tell by his other shorts, he has a real passion for film. And when you speak to him, his passion just shows through. And he just collected the greatest people around him. You know, Lawrence and James Wan, who are on the top, they are the top of the genre. And the DP and the production designer and the actors, he was very open to having the best people come together to help to make his vision come to life. And I think he did a terrific job.
Maria, were there any second thoughts at all when you were first presented with this, thinking maybe it was just a horror film about doing it?
You don't know, because I've been offered these particular genre films in this budget range. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people are trying to do them now after the Blumhouse model started. And I've never done them because they didn't interest me, the character. But when I read this character, I have such great agents. My one agent, Kim, particularly, no matter what the budget is of a film, she'll read it if it's offered to me and say, this is a great part. And this is one where she called and said, this is a great part. And I read it and went, yes, this is a part I really want to do.
Are there films in the horror genre that you do have an affinity for?
No, I think the last horror film I saw was The Exorcist. when I was like 12. I don't really like horror films. I love thrillers. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to see The Girl on the Train.
Oh, yeah.
I love the book so much. I just immediately went, oh my God, is this going to be a movie? And then I saw a trailer for the movie.
Were you able to see the full feature yet for Lights Out? What was your reaction?
I saw it with Heidi and my friend Sarah. And imagine for that first part, the main actors aren't in that first sequence. I had no idea. The mannequins, the warehouse, we were like this. She was screaming so loud. We were like, oh my God, oh my God, grabbing each other. And I never usually sit through a movie at a premiere, but I'm going to sit through it this time because I can't wait to see it with an audience.
Yeah.
I heard it's hysterical when you sit with an audience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even to hear press say that they were like, people were jumping up and screaming.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. I feel like some people were laughing, but I think they were nervous.
Yeah, I was nervous.
It was scary, and you guys are just pretending that you weren't scared and you're laughing instead.
I was
it
definitely
freaked me out.
It was so good.
What freaked you out so much?
Like just not knowing like when Diana was going to appear. And,
right.
Yeah.
But also the sounds.
Yeah.
The sounds.
Yes.
You're scratching.
The scratching and then the writing of Diana.
Yeah.
Like, that was really crazy.
For me, Diana was very interesting because they touched upon a little bit of her origins, and she's not just a demon, but they made her realistic the way they explained it. So it's like,
you felt sorry for her,
and it felt more real, and I wanted to know more about her. Like
I
want to
know
a little more about her.
The question is, who or what is Diana?
Yes.
Did you guys come away thinking she was part of my psychology? She was a ghost. She was like a real person who turned into this monster.
Yeah.
Like, what did you think?
Yeah, I think she was transformed. She had the
sickness. And she was feeding off like your depression.
Yeah. Waiting for a twist that it was you or that it was Teresa or something, but just the fact that she was this weird entity, singular, was satisfying.
She's like, what did you think she was?
An X.
That's the question that I still carry around with me. You know, I see her as part of my psychology, but in terms of being a mutant, a real spirit, a person, I'm not sure. But I love the ending. I think it's such a great twist, which you don't usually see in a horror film.
No. I thought it was part of your psychology the whole time. It was like your depression, and that's why you wanted to take those pills so that you would stop seeing her.
Yeah, exactly.
When was the first time you saw her in the makeup? Was it during a scene, or was it on the set? Or
it was in the trailer when I saw her getting her prosthetics on. I'm really fascinated by that. She had six different layers of prosthetics. I think it was six. Wow. So she went through from a black bodysuit when she was just in the shadow and you couldn't really see her to another layer until you saw the full layer. And she had to eat and drink standing up. I don't know how the heck she went to the bathroom.
As an actor, were you happy that it was not going to be CGI? Did you know that?
I didn't know beforehand it wouldn't be. And I even expected when the movie came out that they might put a lot of CGI in it. But mm-hmm. it was so well done, just with her and the lighting that they had. They didn't need it.
Therese was talking about how with Gabriel, she kind of felt like a mama bear. Did you kind of... Were you both sort of protective of him?
Not at all. Gabriel is like older than me. He's a wise soul. There's nothing like childlike about him. He's like a real like a guy. So he was like working with a real adult actor in a lot of ways. I just didn't think of him as a little kid.
He had a great little face.
There's so many great choices, especially in your scene where you're trying to introduce Diana to him.
Yeah.
And he just runs. I was like, that's a smart thing to do.
He's like, mommy look crazy. Yeah.
Mama's talking to somebody who isn't there.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, I like the fact that you would take on a role of being a parent to an adult, not just a teenage daughter, but an adult daughter.
Yeah.
And, you know, you are still young yourself, but, I mean, is it really just kind of about the work? I mean, would you be, you know, willing to kind of just play anything, a man or, you know, a grandmother, whatever it happens to be, if the role were juicy enough that you felt you could get something out of it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. If I love a role, I just, mm-hmm. I don't think about what it's going to look like or how old I'm going to look or how mm-hmm. ugly I'm going to look or, you know, this one I wore ugly makeup, mm-hmm. right? And I don't, but... That doesn't bother me mm-hmm. at all. And the truth is, I could be Teresa's mother. Mm-hmm. I don't know how old she is, but I'm 49. Mm-hmm. So she's in her late 20s or early 30s. So,
mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? I could be her mother realistically. Mm-hmm. I think when the old time idea of Hollywood films, they would cast someone who was much, much older mm-hmm. to be, right?
Right.
Because, mm-hmm. but the truth is, I could be her mother.
Mm-hmm. You've dedicated, you know, a good portion of your life to works outside of your business.
Yes.
How are you balancing when you find great roles, work with all of the other interests that you have out in the rest of the world?
Well, I would like to say, because I know you know a lot about the journey in Haiti, the school that Paul Haggis and Artists for Peace and Justice, myself and a group of our friends built right after the earthquake with Father Rick Frechette, 2,200 students. 3 weeks ago, we had our first graduating class.
Oh,
it was amazing. It was amazing. Read my article in the Huffington Post and you'll see some pictures. Oh, but, you know, to see these young men and women who live literally on dirt floors with tin shacks, perfectly made up, and the girls with their high heels on, and the men in their bow ties, the first people who'd ever graduated high school and their families, you know, the first people in their families who will have the opportunity to have jobs and... It was just so incredibly moving. It was really great.
Yeah,
so I've had to pull back on going to Haiti so much and doing all of that work. But now, you know, I'm very, very invested in gender equity, pay equity in Hollywood, and equal representation in front of and behind the camera. So that's sort of, and that's here in town.
Are we at a turning point?
We're at such a big turning point. I'm so excited about Ghostbusters this weekend. It says so much. If I had to hear, that's why I'm producing so much now. You know, the old model of financing films based on international sales, based on a white male actor, mm-hmm. is going out the door. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm tired of seeing movie posters with two white guys on them. So 50% of our movie-going audience are women, and it's time to have women front and center out there in movies, not because it's nice, but because it's good business.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your upcoming movies?
I have a film coming out at the Toronto Film Festival called The Journey is the Destination, which I am in and I executive produce as well. I have a film with Viola Davis and her company and F.E.T. Brown. It's an action adventure, which will be announced soon, which is really exciting, based on a treatment that I wrote and something that I created. And a few other little film and TV projects in the works that are female driven.
Yeah. Oh, very busy.
Yeah. I like it. It's fun. It's fun to be creative, and I like to work with a group. I like to inspire people and bring people of like minds and hearts and values together and create something from the ground up. So this is just another sort of level of my career.
Was that something you were working toward, or was it just where you got and you said, oh, now I have the ability to do this?
I was definitely working towards that. You know, 15 years ago even, I would find a book and get the rights to it. But I wasn't at a place in my life with a young child or, you know, emotionally, or maybe didn't have enough experience either to be able to put these things together. Now I'm at an age where I can, and I go, oh, okay, that book, oh, I can get the rights to that. And then, oh, I have these relationships that I've built for 25 years,
right.
And I can just go to so-and-so, lucky me, they'll pick up the phone and be like, oh, I have this great book. Do you want to do this book with me? And they go, yeah, okay. So I think timing's everything.
Yeah. And going back to what you were saying about female roles and not, like, you know, two white guys in, like, a movie poster. Like, I'm finishing up my MBA in 3 weeks. So excited.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so, like, you know, on the business side, we talk about movies and how ticket sales internationally have grown a lot.
Yeah.
And it is because of diversity. And so, you know, you're very right about how...
Well, 80%, is it, of our income from movies comes from international sales. Domestic doesn't even really matter anymore.
No, it doesn't.
It's such a small part of the budget, so... And, you know, and it is a global market now.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that Hollywood starts to think like that, the better they're going to do, as opposed to making these all white male movies.
So as a producer, or do you kind of look at those things yourself? Do you look at, say, a property, a book, or, you know, whatever, and see how this might reach a global audience as opposed to... Okay.
I'm creating a television show right now that I wrote. That is hugely global. There's a kid in it from Africa, a 25-year-old who runs a news agency from Africa. There's a young doctor from Brazil. There's a young techie from China.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm creating a show that's bringing in international actors because we do work in a global community.
Yeah,
that's who we are, and we're more alike than we are different.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the show for? What's it called?
Netflix?
It's not set up yet.
I
want to say. I'm in the process of it, and it's a very exciting process.
Hmm. You're, as a writer, is that a medium you really find a lot of joy doing? You know, because it seems like you write a lot of stuff.
Writing is really, really difficult. Writing my book was one of the hardest things I've ever done. Talk about being vulnerable too, writing about your life. But writing screenplays is even harder. It's a very particular thing, and I wouldn't say I'm excellent at it. I haven't done enough of it. But I prefer to work with other people to be able to get my ideas in a shape of a film or a TV screenplay that makes sense, that can really bring that vision to life.
Who have you learned from most in terms of either the producing side or the filmmaking side? Like, who, because you work with some great directors and so forth.
You know what I would say is one of my greatest mentors and friends is Kathy Schulman.
Hmm.
I don't know if you know Kathy Schulman. She was a producer of Crash. She is. She runs STX right now.
Oh.
She's a very powerful woman who's been in this business for many, many years, who is probably the leader in our industry on gender equality.
Hmm.
And she just knows everything. I can just show her 2 pages of a treatment, and she'll go, okay, that's a budget of $3.2 million. This is what you need to sell it. This is it, right? So she really has a great understanding not only of the financials of making a film, the business side of a film, but also the creativity of the film.
I imagine that, as you said, writing your book was challenging, but the rewards must have been fantastic once you got to have conversations with people who read it and got your experience and got your life.
And you touched people, I'm sure.
So many people. It's, you know, it was such a gift that this conversation was just really coming to a head when the book came out about the fluidity of sexuality and love and relationships and no labels and what all of that meant. And so the book just continues to sell, and people continue to talk about it, and I'm just really proud to be a part of that conversation.
You're just so influential, like, my goodness, like, producer, actor, book writer, businesswoman, like, it's really amazing to see a female doing all of this.
Thank you. Well, it sounds like you're doing it, too.
Thanks. I'm trying.
That's wonderful. Do you want to make films?
No, I'm creating my clothing line.
That's exciting. Yeah. Congratulations. Are you designing or you're doing the business side?
Business. Well, I'm doing both. My own company. I know.
Congratulations.
With everything you're doing, is acting still fun?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
Acting is like a break from my life. It's like my playground. Oh. So when I went in to do even Lights Out, it was so emotional. It's so fun. Because
right.
it's a break from my head and the business side. So
congratulations in Haiti. Are those photos available for publication?
Yeah. Go online to the Huffington Post.
Oh, okay. But for any other publication that wants to write a story, the Huffington Post owns those photos? Is that what
you're saying? But APJ owns them. Artists for Peace and Justice owns them. If you would, how can we get those? Put you in touch with APJ? I could do that.
What are your programs for the gender equality outreach you're doing for film?
There are four different programs at this point. One is called the Gender Parity Stamp, which is very interesting. A studio, a production company, an agency will get a stamp based on how progressive they are in terms of gender equality. There's an outreach program where we go to a studio, maybe with an agent, a producer, and an actor, and talk about unconscious gender bias. We talk about, did you know that in an animated film, only 30% of the background are women? And they go, no. There are these simple little things that people don't draw attention to. So, anyway,
okay.
Thank you so much.
Watch Lights Out in theaters starting July 22nd. Stay tuned for an exclusive interview with first-time director Dan Zandberg and his wife, actress Laura Lisson. Check out more of my interviews here on audioboom.com/channel/dysfunctional. Check out more entertainment news on my blog, dysfunctional.com. Follow me on social media at Dysfunctional on Twitter and Instagram, Dysfunctional LA on Facebook, Dysfunctional on the Good Shows app, now on iTunes and Android, and Dysfunctional on Snapchat.